Hi everyone, my name is Rohan Sant.
And my name is Daniel Olaya. Thank you very much for joining us and welcome to another episode of the Aerospace Medicine Podcast.
I am really excited to introduce our guest today, who can truly be referred to as someone who has written the book on the fundamentals of aerospace medicine. He's the medical director of the Aerospace Medicine Program at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, and a general internal physician in Mayo Clinic's Executive Health Program.
Academically, he has contributed to the field of altitude-related disorders and hyperbaric environment research through his award-winning publications, and now serves as Associate Editor for Clinical Aerospace Medicine for Aerospace Medicine and Human Performance and Life Sciences Associate Editor for Nature Microgravity.
He also co-directs the Aerospace Medicine and Vestibular Research Lab, who are looking at exciting new technologies such as eye-tracking devices and galvanic vestibular stimulation, and their potential uses in improving safety in the aerospace environment. Please welcome Dr. Jan Stepanek.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. But before we carry on, I just want people, you may need to rewind and listen to those accolades slowly because there was so much there. So we don't blame you if you have to do that.
So Dr. Stepanek, that is obviously just a little bit of a tip of the iceberg of the sort of things that you have been involved with over your career within aerospace medicine. But one of the questions we asked everyone when they come on the podcast is this: why aerospace medicine? What brought you to this field? And can you tell us about your journey?
So that actually takes me back, believe it or not, to the mountains in Switzerland where I grew up. And notably, some of the time that I spent in the Swiss military. You know, I was first assigned to the mountain infantry divisions. And as a result of that, as a physician and as a medic, I got the opportunity to see how individuals who happen to not live at necessarily high altitude, but other are brought together as part of the military effort to train at altitude and then suffer the consequences. You know, some of these individuals, you know, got significant mountain sickness, you know, didn't feel well. I got a taste of it myself. And as a result of that, it sort of piqued an interest. I've always been a mountaineer and someone who enjoyed mountaineering and hiking in the mountains. But that really was the first stimulus that made me appreciate the environment and what the environment does to the human body and how pedestrian we look at ambient barometric pressure, and yet how important it impact it has on our overall health and human performance. I then decided to train in internal medicine, had the opportunity to spend time training at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and was selected as chief resident. After my training at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, I was thinking about, well, you know, should I go back home to Switzerland and take over the practice of my father in internal medicine, or would there be opportunities for additional specialty training? And, you know, I was pondering a lot of different directions, from cardiology to gastroenterology to nephrology. And then, you know, a colleague, Dr. Hickman, approached me at Mayo Clinic in Rochester and asked me, you know, would you be interested in potentially investigating and looking at a career in aerospace medicine? And I, to my shame today, admit that my first question was, there is such a thing?
And that's a simple question.
Yep. And I was then given the opportunity to learn a little bit about what the field in the United States looks like, because aerospace medicine is not an established subspecialty or specialty certificate in many countries. You know, there is the acknowledgement that, yes, you know, people struggle with altitude. Yes, people are pilots and have special needs. Yes, there is space flight. But it's not due to the volume or relative lack thereof in many a country sufficient to be a subspecialty. And so I went on to do training and spent first 2 years working as a flight surgeon in the Swiss Air Force, ran their altitude indoctrination program, did some acceleration research investigating new G-suits, And then subsequent to that, was fortunate to be able to do my training at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston with a fair amount of opportunity and activities at Johnson Space Center. Then thereafter returned to Mayo Clinic in Rochester and started my clinical work up there up until 2005, when I saw the opportunity to actually go visit snow as opposed to snow coming to visit me, and chose to relocate to Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, where I continued my work.
Wow, you've explained that extremely eloquently, but actually there's a huge amount that we unpick there. So you started off obviously growing up in Switzerland, and then you made the decision to come over to the United States as a fellow, well, Europeans, I suppose we can still say that somewhat, Daniel. You know, that's not an easy decision to be able to make, to be able to abandon everything and then come over to the US. I'm interested in what the thought process and the weighing up of pros and cons behind that decision would be, if you're able to explore that a little bit further.
So I will tell you that as a medical student in Switzerland, we have the opportunity to do selective rotations. So part of our curriculum in latter stages of our training is the opportunity to go and rotate outside of country and outside of Switzerland in general, and get experiences in multiple locations.
Wow.
I had the opportunity, due to some family connections, to learn about Mayo Clinic. And one of my actually teachers in military strategy, Major Boschung, you know, he had mentioned, because he had grown up as a small child with his father having been a physician in training at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, he encouraged me and said, listen, you need to go over there and just see how they practice medicine, because it's different from any other place that my father had seen and I had seen. So I thought, well, I'll give it a try. I applied. You know, it was an process of selection and writing letters, and finally I was lucky enough to be able to rotate at Mayo Clinic in Rochester in adult and pediatric cardiology. And when I was there, I fell in love with the culture. I fell in love with the instantiation of sort of the integrated group practice, where there was truly a lot of teaching of consultants, not just the trainees, but also each other. And it was a mode of practice and a mode of communication that really suited me. And so I decided, upon leaving, I had a discussion with Dr. Henry Schultz, who was the program director of the internal medicine program, and asked him, so what is it that I need to do in order to be able to potentially do internal medicine training here? And we spent time in his office, and he literally took out a yellow notepad and wrote down 10 bullet points of what it is that I have to achieve in order to be competitive. So I took that yellow notepad sheet of paper, I still have it for that matter, I got to work. You know, there were arduous things on there besides, you know, making sure that I finish my credentials in Switzerland to be a physician, but also at the same time finish the credentials and the testing that would allow me to actually enter into clinical training in the US. You know, things that stipulated, you know, how good I had to be in comparison to all other graduates in Switzerland. Needless to say, you know, it was a fair amount of work, but understandably so. And before I was aware and done, I had the opportunity to call him and tell him, Dr. Schultz, I'm done with your list. What are the next steps? And that's how I got to start.
Wow. Incredible. I want to unpack a few things. First of all, you mentioned the mentors you had, the people that you looked up to, and the help and the motivation that you received from them. And initially, when you mentioned that you were able to go into the mountains in the military, you know, you actually saw aviation, altitude, from a different perspective to most people when they first get into it. Because most people look at the stars, most people look at airplanes, most people look at all those things, but you actually saw the physiology happening in front of you. And that's a really, really unique perspective. I've really not heard that before. And it just goes to show, you know, really interesting.
Various different paths in order to be able to access that. So then after that, you had been introduced to this field of aviation and aerospace medicine, and you had a choice of different things at that time. What was it specifically about that field that excited you?
So the thing that is interesting about aerospace medicine, and aerospace medicine has one huge handicap in my book, and that is when you say that you practice aerospace medicine, everybody goes like, well, that is really cool. And then there's a pregnant pause. And you go like, what is it that you actually do? And that is a problem. And, you know, all banter aside, I think the important thing is in aerospace medicine that we recognize how we can be of service to the people that we serve, but also how we can be of service as consultants and as resources to colleagues of ours. There is a misperception that this is a field that is rooted in technicalities and just incredible feats. That is true, but it is rooted in the deep understanding of physiology and how physiology impacts the human body in disease states, but also in healthy states, and what it is that as clinicians we can do to help mitigate against that. So if you really deeply delve into this, you will find yourself looking at first blush extraneous and potentially just cool things that appear to be only applicable to spaceflight. But very quickly, it actually becomes incredibly germane and novel and important and of value to patients that you see on a daily basis. I'll give you an example. You know, in clinical practice, it is not infrequent that I see patients that come to see me and are referred to me because they have dizziness and they've had the mother of all workups already. You know, their vestibular system is normal, their heart is normal. And really, their key complaint why they first came to their primary care physician was, you know, when I bent over and my head is at knee level when I tie my shoes, and then I stand up, I feel like I'm about to pass out. And the point that is important here to make is that in aerospace medicine, we know this concept in a markedly enhanced and larger fashion as a threat called push-pull effect, meaning that you have due to negative G-forces, you have now relative fullness of the aortic baroreceptors and the carotid baroreceptors, causing your heart to now decrease your heart rate, decrease your cardiac output, decrease your blood pressure. And then when you start pulling G-forces again, you know, you're going to be likely to pass out. Now, if you take that very same concept now under 1G conditions in someone who happens to have low blood pressure to begin with, this is the same physiology. You know, once you understand that, you can actually appreciate, explain it to the patient, and help guide any additional information gathering if that is even necessary, because this can be part of normal physiology. So the point is that the physiology is all around us, and this is more than just, you know, high flying and high performance. Yes, that is important as well, but it's also good old-fashioned medicine that is important for all of us.
Again, another theme and concept which we're hearing time and time again from such, you know, great people who've done great things is that aerospace medicine, aviation medicine, all the great things is rooted upon learning physiology, learning the basics well, understanding the human body. And that starts all the way at medical school and even beforehand. So all the medical students, you know, thinking about doing great things, it starts with the simple stuff, do the simple stuff very, very well.
I think it also points a little bit to, in order to be able to contribute perhaps to the field of aerospace medicine, maybe you can get your opinion on this, Dr. Stepanek, in terms of what you feel. But it's like, in order to contribute, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to have necessarily done a specific aerospace medicine program. It's about making sure that you can contribute even as a, for example, cardiologist or a nephrologist who happens to just have a bit of an interest in aerospace medicine, but really has a great understanding of that concept and that subject really well, which is perhaps encouraging to people who maybe think that actually, I don't know if I can pursue this field in my country or if I have the ability to, or if I necessarily feel like that's my primary interest. But I do want to be able to contribute in some way to it. I didn't know what you thought about that as a statement, Dr. Shabanek.
I think it's a very important one. So there is a lot of value by a lot of people in the general science and medical community that have contributed tremendously to the science of spaceflight by thinking deeply about what it is that happens to the human body, how can this be investigated, and how can it be potentially mitigated. And as a result of that, you don't need to necessarily have an aerospace medicine residency if you do not wish to invest the time for that. Because let's face it, you know, it's a commitment. It's a commitment of time. It's a commitment of resources. And, you know, if you're really serious about this and you want to make this your life's work, then that is going to be worth your while. If it turns out that you feel like, well, I have an interest in it, but it's not an interest that would justify spending 2 years of my life, you know, doing a specific aspect of training to have the credentials, it's always a matter of what it is that you try to achieve. But your point is a very good one. There's a lot of individuals in the community of, you name the specialty, you know, from dermatology to obstetrics, gynecology to anesthesia, that have thought deeply about what are some of the aspects and issues that could be facing someone who's, for instance, in exploration class spaceflight or on the moon, or, you know, how are we going to deal with the things that we deal with here on Earth based on constrained resources in spaceflight. That does not necessarily require an aerospace medicine board certification, but it does require an interest that would allow you to delve deeply and have conversations. And those opportunities are out there for the taking for pretty much everybody. And they're important.
Now, you've trained in internal medicine and aerospace medicine. How does your working life and career reflect those two choices and those two sort of training pathways that you've done? Are you still able to do the craft of internal medicine that we understand it, as in the hospital doing standard internal medicine alongside aerospace and aviation medicine? Does that still happen, or does one have to get weaker for the other one to thrive?
Now, that's a very good question, and I would argue that the biggest value to operational space medicine, exploration class missions, any austere environment, is provided by someone who happens to be strong and clinically grounded in a specialty of internal medicine, you know, family medicine, you know, have a really strong grasp of whatever specialty it is that your primary specialty is, because they cross-pollinate. I'm a better internist based on my appreciation of the physiology of altitude and what it does to the human body and how patients respond to that environment. And I can provide value to my colleagues in other specialties by providing consultation, guidance, testing that otherwise would not have arisen or occurred. If I would not be an internist, I would not have the ability to have the knowledge and context of what are some of the investigative techniques and methods and medication management strategies that we could use to approach certain entities and diseases. So I do think that it actually makes me stronger that way. I do 50% of my time is spent doing aerospace medicine and 50% is spent doing good old-fashioned internal medicine. And the aerospace medicine part is taking care of pilots, you know, getting them back to flight status after they have had diseases or illnesses, working with commercial spaceflight companies, you know, doing some work for NASA, you know, as an external expert, you know, engagement in education. But I would argue the most likely and important point that someone would come to see me here at Mayo Clinic in Arizona is probably altitude. And that turns out to be something that may seem odd, because when people ask me, so you run the altitude clinic for the institution in Arizona, how high is your altitude clinic? And my response is 1,500 feet, you know, which is very, very low elevation. But we are really in a situation here in the Mountain West, here in the U.S., where you have 5 million people at our doorstep that happen to live in the low Sonoran Desert. And if they want to get out of the heat of Phoenix or recreate, they typically drive for about 2.5 hours, and they find themselves at elevations well above 2,000 meters or 7,000 feet, 8,000 feet. They can go up to close to 4,000 meters in the San Francisco peaks. So you have a large population of unacclimatized individuals with a variety of medical ailments, conditions, and underlying issues that are now traveling to altitude, which makes for a rich cadre of opportunity for someone with my background to potentially be of assistance.
Well, there's a few things that I also want to highlight, though, is that, I mean, obviously we're Brits, me, myself, and Daniel, so we kind of have an understanding of what the American system looks like, but I do recognize that there may be people who are listening who actually don't understand what that looks like. So from what I've seen and understand of the American system in terms of getting into aerospace medicine, in order to do a residency or a training program within it, you need to have done another residency prior to this. Is that correct in that understanding, or is that not always the case?
That is, I would argue that that is smart, but not necessarily necessary.
I see. Okay.
Let me give you a little bit of context here. So historically, because a lot of the growth in aerospace medicine in this country emanated from the need of the military, a lot of individuals, you know, went through medical school potentially on funding from the Department of Defense, and then went on to do training in a specialty that was to their liking and to the needs also of the Department of Defense. And because of the large flying assets in the U.S. military, aerospace medicine was not an uncommon and unreasonable choice. Now, aerospace medicine, you know, once you get out of the military, there is work, but there is very few practitioners, I would argue, that turn out to probably practice exclusively aerospace medicine. Obviously, people in, you know, federal agencies, the FAA, you know, the NTSB, you know, there is an intersprinkling of opportunities for full-time jobs. But more often than not, there is the need to also have another leg to stand on. And contingent on the reality of what the jobs market for pilots look like, the demand for pilots looks like, you know, what the economy looks like, you know,
absolutely,
if we happen
yeah,
to
yeah,
or
absolutely.
Not have a pandemic, you know, all of those things, you know, turn out to be important. And as a result of that, I tell all of my mentees when I have discussions with them, I tell them, make sure that you ideally have two specialties, you know, one, you know, that you have sort of your other leg that you can pivot to if it were to be that you find yourself in a situation where there's not going to be as much opportunity in the aerospace medicine domain, because it is a small area where you can provide a lot of value. But it turns out that it is somewhat subject to the vagaries of the economy and opportunities or lack thereof.
I see. Okay. So in order to be able to practice as an aerospace medicine physician in the States, when you mentioned that it was, you could just pursue it as its own specialty individually and start off there. But from what you're telling me, it seems to be that's mainly within the military organizations. Is that correct or is that incorrect? The reason I mention it is because having spoken and been part of the Principles of Aviation and Space Medicine course at UTMB, which I know that you've heard of before, it seemed to be that in order to get the residency there, you had to have made sure that you have been board certified or qualified in another specialty, because the main thing is that they're looking for excellent clinicians who they'll then turn into aerospace medicine doctors. So that's the reason why I was asking that question, and if it was in that way or if I'm wrong, I'm happy to be corrected.
No, you know, there's the reality of what the opportunity is based on certification requirements. You know, could you do, for instance, medical school, you graduate from medical school and then you choose to do aerospace medicine residency training? Yeah, you could. But based on the requirements on what it is and what type of clinicians are sought in the field currently, your opportunities to get a job would probably be somewhat more limited. And keep in mind that residencies such as UTMB, they're really trying to feed the pipeline for the needs of NASA. So they really do want to have someone who has a strong clinical background. And as a result of that, then adds to that the training. And as a result of that, you can shave 1 year worth of clinical requirements off of that. So you can get it done in 2 years with all the coursework for the MPH and some of the additional training. And that's really the reason why there is this desire to have individuals already come in with some clinical acumen from another specialty, just because that's the type of physician and healthcare provider that they're seeking.
Fine. So to summarize, it's basically dependent upon the institution from which you are actually going to pursue the aerospace medicine residency that will necessarily determine what you do before.
Absolutely. So I can tell you, for instance, the Mayo Clinic fellowship that we have at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, there is the expectation that you're coming in and you already are board certified, be that in internal medicine, emergency medicine, or whatever other specialty before you pursue the fellowship training and then become board eligible as a result of that training in aerospace medicine in addition to your primary specialty.
There's an interesting and quite well-known article in the British Journal of Anesthesia, which discusses what a space doctor looks like, what an aerospace medicine doctor actually looks like, both on the ground and in space. You know, what actually makes up that professional responsibility in terms of training. And there's a lot of discussion about anesthesiology, internal medicine, and emergency medicine. My question to you is, what speciality do you think best would make up, in inverted commas, the space doctor? And what do you see coming up in terms of numbers and in terms of, you know, the general populations that you see coming up to fill that role?
This is an important question because there is a common misperception as to what it is that we do in aerospace medicine and space medicine specifically. There is this misperception that it's all about launch and landing. And that is when you need to do contingency and emergency medicine response and, you know, when things go sideways. The reality is that the physics of these vehicles, be that on launch or be that on landing, are not kind to human beings. So the reality that you would have to do a lot of emergency medicine response, let's say on launch and landing, is somewhat small. If things go sideways, they're not going to be, opportunity to rescue a lot of people, probably. The boatload of what it is that you'll be doing clinically is going to be contingent on the mission. So it's a very different story if you do a low Earth orbit mission for a couple of days to a destination such as the International Space Station or another location. You can select individuals that can be perfectly screened, quarantined, healthy before they go up. The likelihood that something will go sideways during that brief stay in low Earth orbit is essentially nil, close to nil. The longer the stay is and the further away you get from planet Earth and the more constrained your return to medical care opportunity is and the more constrained your resources are that you have with you, the more medically interesting this will get. So, you know, it gets to be very quickly if you happen to have a mission to Mars, an exploration class mission, and, you know, you have a crew and you have limited resources. While it's important to talk about, for instance, anesthesiology, I think the primary goal in that context is not so much intubation, ventilation, vent management. Because if you have a condition that will stipulate that you now need to intubate and ventilate someone, then not only have you committed an extraordinary amount of resources, but the condition is going to be exceedingly severe. And as a result of that, you're going to have to think about, well, does this make sense? If I have, let's say, 10 people on this mission or 8 people on this mission, we're in the beginning of this mission and we cannot turn around. So we're going. You know, how much resources are you going to commit to a given person who's suffering from a problem? Are you going to be trying to do an appendectomy with anesthesia and intubation, knowing full well that you can't use inhaled anesthetics due to the contamination of the spacecraft atmosphere? Or will you more likely lean towards trying to manage this with as best as you can with antibiotic therapy and conservative measures? It's probably going to be the latter versus the former. So the perception of the high-tech environment and the resources that are available does not necessarily jibe with the reality of how much resources do you have medically and what is it that you can do. So I think the biggest job that we do in space medicine and aerospace medicine is prevention. So it's the ability to have people be as smart as they can be, to be able to do as much as they can do with the little resources that they'll have available, help them be selected such that they have an optimal crew composition with minimizing the likelihood, the pretest probability for problem to occur. And that encompasses potentially medications. It does encompass exercise countermeasures. It does encompass diet. Those things in exploration class missions, the longer the mission is, the more important they become. So I'm not trying to take away from the importance of any given specialty, but you know, that is my personal bias based on just looking at, you know, what it is that we will have available and, you know, how much people we will have and what is it that we can do.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Dr. Stepanek, because I think that is probably one of the most eloquent explanations of why aerospace medicine by its nature almost has to be a preventative medicine specialty. Because even though, you know, we can all be very excited perhaps about the absolute latest in technology being launched into space, that we have to make sure that that investment is as protected as it can be, I suppose, but also that we have to think about what we're actually going to be sending up there. And if you have a situation, we want to try and prevent the situation that you would need to have, for example, as you said, an appendix removed in space or have intubation happen in space. And that's the reason why actually the main goals really is to make sure that we use those best, we utilize the resource management as best as we can. And the best way to do that is to prevent it happening in the first place.
Yep, it's something that is probably in the current environment not well understood, because there is a sense of, well, this is about emergencies and emergency responses. The reality is when things go badly in spaceflight, there is no such thing as a small problem. You know, if things go badly in spaceflight, you know, then we're dealing with big changes in pressure, you know, big forces that are impacting us. So the best we can do is try to mitigate as best as we can what we know to mitigate ahead of time. And that's why I think, you know, someone who has a deep understanding in multi-organ system functioning of the human body is going to be someone who's probably going to be of utility, if not for other reason than to be able to put some of these pieces together and, you know, help guide the conversation, even if they don't turn out to be the point person specialist, but they will know exactly, well, this is the people we need to pull in to solve this problem.
Obviously, right now, you are the medical director of the aerospace medicine program at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona. Can you summarize to us what that actually looks like and what is it that you do?
So what I do with that is underneath that job description or title, you know, falls the organization. I function as a consultant to the Federal Air Surgeon, a Class 1 FAA examiner. You know, I coordinate and oversee the pilot examinations between me and one of my colleagues who works in the program. You know, we do the altitude assessments and evaluations, have close collaborations with our colleagues in cardiology, work with commercial spaceflight companies, do evaluations of prospective spaceflight passengers who potentially have medical issues. So, you know, that's sort of the parlance of what that entails. I also teach as part and parcel at our medical school and provide opportunities for fellows, internal medicine residents, cardiology fellows, pulmonary fellows, to have rotations and opportunities for further education in that subject matter domain.
Is there any online learning platforms for perhaps medical students or those that live and study further afield that they can engage in from your program?
So at this point in time, you know, because we're a lean, mean fighting machine here, so a small group of people who try to do a lot of work, we do have some learning resources that have been put together over the course of this past year and courtesy of the pandemic. So that hopefully will be available down the road. Currently, there is very little available externally to Mayo, but hopefully we'll be able to make that happen in the ensuing year.
So what brought you to deciding that this is the director role is what you wanted to go for?
It was really not so much a desire to become a director of this, but rather, you know, someone had to do it to be able to administratively move the unit forward and allow for the administrative existence within the organizational chart of Mayo Clinic. And with that, the ability to do meaningful clinical work and be supported in doing so. So it was really not a desire of me hunting for a title.
But you were the right person at the right time, and that's the reason you're doing
the job. That's probably adequate because I was the only one at that point.
When it comes to academia, you've been involved in some really exciting research, especially around spatial disorientation and use of the galvanic vestibular stimulation, or the GVS. Can you explain what the GVS is and what that's about?
I'll be happy to. So I've been very blessed to be able to work with my colleague and co-director of our Aerospace Medicine Vestibular Research Laboratory, Dr. Savette, since 2005. It's a self-funded laboratory, and we really focused on main areas that are a risk to pilots, have been a risk to pilots, including altitude-related threats, spatial disorientation, and to a lesser extent, also aspects of acceleration. But the two first that I mentioned are really the key ones that we work on. Now, with spatial disorientation, the concept of spatial disorientation rests in our inability as visually dominant creatures to make sense of three-dimensional space, courtesy of the input from our neurovestibular system, somatosensory joint position system that give us cues and feedback, which work beautifully as long as we see, and they work beautifully as long as we are in a 1G nominal pedestrian environment. As soon as you take us humans into a flying envelope, especially when you alter G-forces and G-vectors, you will very, very quickly, especially if you take away visual inputs, such as when you're flying in cloud or when you're flying at nighttime, our human body gets to be very, very quickly disoriented. And that disorientation is due to our primary reliance on vision, you know, as creatures. And the neurovestibular system, you have the semicircular canal. So you have the anterior semicircular canal that is responsible for the sensation of pitch, so head forward. You have the lateral semicircular canal, which is responsible for yaw or turning your head sideways. And then you have the posterior semicircular canal, which is responsible for, you know, putting your head towards your shoulder on either side. And that is how we sense angular acceleration. And you have the neurovestibular inputs from the saccule and the utricle. So the utricle is linear acceleration, so like being catapulted off of a aircraft carrier, a sense of, you know, flipping backward. That is spatial disorientation courtesy of the utricle. The saccule basically tells us, well, this is vertical, this is down, you know, this is sort of the vertical acceleration vector. Now, we've known for a long time that all of these signals are conveyed to the brain through electrical impulses. You know, that is how the eighth nerve actually does what it does for us, because it's hooked up to the vestibular system. And all the way back to Volta, there was descriptions that whenever someone would put an electrical current anode to cathode from ear to ear, there would be a profound sense of turning. So we knew from a long time ago that there was a ability to influence the firing rate of the eighth nerve and evoke perceptions, but it was never possible to do that in a predetermined fashion to be able to give truly meaningful inputs to the vestibular system that would be congruent with what it is that visually is presented to the individual. And I'll get back to that in just a second. So what we've come up with GBS, as I said, GBS is not a new technology, but the new aspect of our work was to be able to show that if you provide that current from four electrodes, two behind the ears and one on the forehead, one at the level of the nape of the neck, and you vector that current in a predetermined fashion, I can literally give you the perception of pitch, yaw, and roll if you're sitting in a chair in the dark. And now all of a sudden, you know, this gets to be very interesting aeromedically, but also from a perspective of, for instance, VR. So if you think of some of the newest airplanes, you know, the thrust vectored flights of some of the Russian aircraft, but also US aircraft, you can now fly well beyond the stall envelope of that aircraft, meaning that the airplane can do things that the human inside it will probably have a really hard time withstanding. And the reason for that is because there will be this violent conflict between what the human sees versus what the airplane does. So being able to inform and get these signals to the human to be able to mitigate some of these conflicting and disorienting inputs is of significant potential value. It's something that can help, you know, in clinical context with fall prevention, but more pedestrian. I don't know about you guys, but if someone puts a VR goggle on me and puts a visual scene on that entails a lot of vection, so a very fast moving scene where things are moving past me quickly, I will not enjoy this for a long time, because what you have is you have a fast moving visual scene, and by your inner ear is telling you you're not moving, and your eyes are telling you yes you are, and it's fast, and your inner ear tells you no you're not. And at some point in time, that conflict will then lead to cyber sickness or VR sickness. So this is something we know from flight simulators. We know it from cyber sickness, VR sickness. So there is opportunities in that domain, both clinically, but also for the purposes of supporting the human to use some of that technology.
Wow. So just to summarize everything you've just said, is that you, through your research and the placing of electrodes at various points around the skull, you're able to effectively stimulate the vestibular system in almost any which way you want to give the illusion that they're experiencing certain movement effects when actually they're not doing so. And then in the reason why that's potentially got clinical applications is that when the reason that we feel sick is when there's a discrepancy between what the eyes are seeing and what the vestibular system is experiencing. And so what you're hinting at is actually if you are able to coordinate those two things together, interpret or predict perhaps what the individual is going to be seeing, and then also coordinate that with what their vestibular system is experiencing, then that is a way to be able to reduce them feeling sick and therefore to optimize them to be able to fulfill their function, both in terms of in this situation in military pilots, but also you've found another application perhaps in VR as well.
Absolutely. You know, if you've ever experienced vertigo, you know how debilitating it is and how miserable it is. One of the worst things that can happen is if you have sudden unilateral vestibular loss. Your body will eventually adapt, but the journey to adaptation is going to be one filled with, regrettably, a lot of nausea and a lot of misery. So, you know, it would be very, very helpful to be able to potentially intervene and help these people beyond just dulling their senses, because currently what we're doing is we're giving them anti-nausea medicines or sedatives. And what they do is, yes, they dull your sense of self-motion, but they will dull you too. And that is in the hope of allowing these individuals to adapt over time. But there ought to be better, more sophisticated ways of approaching this. So, you know, there's hope that down the road, some of these methods will also enter into some clinical applications beyond just the research or entertainment or military domain.
Incredible. I mean, excuse me for jumping the gun on this or taking it out of context, but are you saying that using this type of technology and VR, we can simulate flying like Superman?
Conceivably, you know, it will give you the input that your vestibular system is going to sense based on what it is that you're seeing. Now, you know, what you're not going to get is you're not going to get some of the somatosensory input. So if you're good at being Superman, you would expect that if you're flying really fast, you'll have some friction against your body as a result of the motion of flying. That obviously is not going to happen if you happen to sit in the chair, nor will your joint position sense be consistent with having a Superman pose and try to fly. But at least the consistency of the vestibular input and the visual input will safeguard you from having VR sickness and may enhance your sense of being present in what is being displayed to your brain.
A scientific, beautiful answer to that question, which is much appreciated.
My pleasure.
I'm just looking at the time and I'm aware that you've just been bleeped, Dr. Stepanek. So we will draw the interview to a close at this stage. But I can only say that it's been a whistle-stop tour, but we've covered so much in just a short amount of time. And I think it's just really been incredible to just listen to you and hear you speak.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
From cross-pollination and career advice to walking up in the mountains, in the Swiss Alps, to flying like Superman. Dr. Stepanek, you've been fantastic and a real pleasure to listen to and talk to. And I'm sure all the listeners will gain a lot from what you've said. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for downloading and listening to our podcast. We hope that you gained a lot from it.
And if you'd like to hear some more stuff like this, much more, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you found this on. And if you like what you heard, drop us a rating too.
You can also give us a follow on our social media accounts. We are at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And once again, that's at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter.
Also, we like to hear your feedback, of course, improve. So let us know your thoughts by emailing us at aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com. That's aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com.
Until next time, though, thanks so much again for listening. Stay safe, keep aiming high, and we will see you very, very soon.